from Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Former Illinois Congressman Aaron Schock now off the hook.
About 24 felony corruption charges to be dropped after Schock pays $150,000 and cooperates with the IRS.
There's relatively a slap on the wrist considering in a few months he was actually going to be in this building facing federal corruption charges.
4 years ago, I left office among a lot of media flurry that I said then was overblown and unjustified, but there's a difference between mistakes and crimes. And I've said from the beginning that there was never an attempt by me or my staff to commit crimes.
It's time that we stabilized our state's finances so we can give businesses and new entrepreneurs the certainty that Illinois has its fiscal house in order. First of all, this tax plan does ask people who are wealthier to pay more, but not unreasonably so. And it does give a tax break to 97% of people across the state of Illinois.
Democrats are negotiating with themselves, as far as I can tell. Certainly the House Republicans are not in there. They've got that resolution that I think appropriately says, hey, this is just a bad concept. Bill Brady and his conservative Republicans in the Senate, I don't think are on board. So the question is, who's in those meetings?
Governor J.B. Pritzker finally details what he wants from a graduated income tax. Business leaders like Todd Meisch, who's with the Illinois Chamber of Commerce, you heard him there, they aren't fans of it. And the Aaron Schock saga comes to an end. We'll talk more about the former congressman who had charges against him dropped this week. That and more coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also with us, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio Statehouse editor, Daisy Contreras, IPR Statehouse reporter, and Tony Arnold is on the line from Chicago with us. He's the WBEZ Illinois politics reporter. Tony, good to talk with you once again.
All right, thanks for having me.
Brian, I'll go to you first. The governor coming out with, I guess, what you could call a bit of a plan for the graduated income tax throughout some numbers. We've been waiting to see those. What do they show?
They show if you want to take his messaging, that the vast majority of Illinoisans are going to be getting a slight, very small tax break, and that people who are above people who earn more than $250,000 are going to be seeing a tax increase. That ramps up slowly until you hit $1 million. It is a true graduated tax until that level. The higher amounts of income are taxed at higher rates until you hit $1 million, and then there's like this recapturing provision. If you make more than $1 million, it becomes a flat tax again, almost 8%. Which is up from the current almost 5% flat tax under current Illinois law.
Is this in line with what we were hearing from him during the campaign, during the many months that he was a bit more stealth about what was going to be in such a package?
Yes and no. I mean, I guess it is mostly a graduated tax if you're not a millionaire. If you are a millionaire, it is not a graduated tax. But that's basically all he said. His campaign was, you know, Illinois needs, in his phrasing, a fair tax. And he never got into details. And this is despite reporters asking him at some point during the campaign. It seemed like almost every public appearance he made, every debate, reporters would ask. You just felt this obligation to say, are you going to give your details now? When are you going to give details about this? But he pinned his campaign on it. He held fast to his vagueness until this week.
And Tony, it sounds like there's some confusion as to whether or not the numbers add up.
Yeah, I think the motive that Governor Pritzker's, you know, cited for moving to the system is that the current tax system of a flat tax is inequitable and unfair to poor people. But that said, we don't know the motive for how he reached these numbers. We don't know why $250,000 is seen as this an income is seen as this leaping off point. Why not $200,000? Why not $175,000? Why not higher than that? I don't know. We don't know just kind of where these numbers came from. Who did the governor consult in coming up with these numbers? How much is he going to be kind of a stick in the mud about these are my numbers and this is how it's going to be, as opposed to being open to negotiating with other Democrats, business groups, Republicans, and negotiating these things. He always said during the campaign, you know, elect me, and then we'll talk about the numbers so that I can negotiate with legislators. Well, now, you know, I guess this is the starting point for negotiations. I don't know where they go from here. I don't know if those numbers go up, go down, how seriously to take these percents as what's going to be the final version. And so there's just still a lot of questions about how much these rates are really going to stick and also where they came from.
And, you know, it's very interesting, too. I mean, he continued with his idea of this is for working families. His proposal also includes a property tax relief for families making, again, the $250,000. Less than that a year, it would be a $100 million increase in their property tax credit. He also includes a proposal for a tax credit for $100 per child for families raising children. And then he breaks that up even further, depending on how many kids in the family and how much each family is earning.
Charlie, what's your thoughts on this?
Well, it seems to me that this is a good first step, and there are a couple, I guess, questions. One has to do with the demographics. Some of the opponents of a graduated income tax have suggested that Governor Pritzker's breakdown of which percentage of Illinoisans would pay less or more depends on how you break down the, you know, the Illinois taxpayers into how many people are there in these various groups, and they're questioning whether or not those are accurate estimates of, for example, how many millionaires are there. Then the other question goes to what will the ultimate rates finally be. This is, I think, a good first step, and if you think about it, we won't actually be able to enact any of this with, what would you say, legal certainty for 2 years. Before any of this stuff can happen, we need to change the Constitution to permit this kind of a graduated rate structure. The Constitution now says that income taxes have to be leveled at a flat rate. And so that has to be changed. That can't happen before November of 2020 or 2020. And then we go into the period of having to develop a budget in the legislative session that would follow that, or maybe the lame duck session when you could enact these rates. But they're a long way away, and there's a lot of time, I think, for negotiation, for maneuvering, for showing the demographic tables that back up the estimates of how much money will be raised. And it's far from done, but I think it's a good first step, because I think this responds to the arguments that were being made against it, that, well, the reason that you won't tell us is because everybody's going to have to pay more taxes. Well, his plan that's laid out here, no, most people won't have to pay more. They'll get, you know, a relatively tiny break, but that's better than having to pay more.
I would just say, to build off of what Charlie's saying, the way that the governor structured this is essentially six, brackets or layers, or for lack of a better word. And 70% of the population, according to his numbers, basically fit into two of these brackets. And I guess it's also another worth asking him about why there aren't more brackets. Why do you bunch 70% of the population into two rates, which is basically the current rate, 4.95%, and then also 4.9% of their income for anyone making, I believe, less than $100,000. So there's just some more questions there about how he's structured this and why he's lumping most of the population into these two brackets or groups.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I would suggest that's kind of open for negotiations. This is from my, what would you say, sense of his talk during the campaign, and when he laid this out, this is like a starting point. He wants people to come to the table, and we'll say, okay, well, maybe it should be three of these brackets, or maybe they should be divided by $75,000 rather than $100,000. That's kind of all up for grabs. Maybe the property tax credit should be larger. Maybe the child tax credit should be less. So there's a lot of moving parts that need to be worked out. And as I said earlier, there's a lot of time to get it done, because none of this can become law until we change the Constitution, which is far from a done deal.
Brian, let me ask you this, because I think when Charlie's mentioning the fact that it could take a while for this to occur, is the governor talking about trying to push this during this legislative session? A lot of times lawmakers don't like to deal with tax issues in an election year, which would be next year. So is it something that's on the table for the next couple of months here?
It seems to be. This is something that we've seen reporting that the governor is actually going to be going to New York to meet with the bond rating people because Illinois is going to be going to the debt market this year. And his budget kind of landed with a thud in their eyes from the reports we've heard from them. So this is in order to say, OK, yes, this year's budget is pretty ugly, or I should say the coming budget year. You know, that proposal is pretty ugly. It kind of limps along. But it's all because we are heading toward this bright, shining city on the hill of the graduated income tax from the governor's perspective. So he needs people to think that that is a strong goal that Illinois Democrats are marching toward in order for them to accept what is admittedly kind of a scotch tape and bent coat hangers and chewing gum stuck together, holding the state budget together until we could get to that point. And this is also, I think it's worth pausing to think about the framing he's trying to put around the discussion of this. So when he announced these rates at a news conference in the Capitol on Thursday afternoon, he said Illinois really has three options. You can do this plan, we can raise the current flat income tax rate on everybody in the state, all income levels, or we can make a 15% across state government, both lower secondary and elementary education, higher education, prisons, state police, everything that state government does can be cut by 15%. Again, those are his numbers. That's what it was basically a PowerPoint slide. We haven't seen detailed explanations of how he got to these numbers. But that is the groundwork on which the governor would like this debate to be had. It's not that we're doing this so we can, you know, create a bunch of lavish new programs. This is just what it's going to take to meet the current deficits for what we have now happening in state government.
Tony, $250,000 in like the Springfield area and many other downstate parts of Illinois, that's a lot of money, and it won't impact probably as many people. But you get up into the suburban areas, into the city, $250,000 is not necessarily wealthy. So what's the likelihood of how this is going to be received in those areas?
I guess $250,000, and I think there are plenty of people in Chicago area who'd love to have that kind of income. But you're right that that money does not go as far in, you know, the city or even some of the suburbs as it would in other parts of the state. You saw that debate play out with the minimum wage debate and whether it should be $15 across the whole state. An hour, $15 an hour across the whole state, or just in the Chicago area, and something else for the areas like Peoria or Springfield. I think the opponents to this graduated income tax rate have been saying, you know, you start raising the taxes on rich people or people who are making more than $250,000, and they're gonna start looking other places to move to. And I suppose you might see some of that, at least some people who have been vocal opponents to particularly Governor Pritzker. But look, Governor Pritzker's his reputation is on this plan. He campaigned heavily on this moving to a graduated income tax rate. If this doesn't go, if there's roadblocks that come up, get put up, it's fallen on him, and he's going to have a real heck of a time running for reelection if this makes it to the ballot next year, and those opponents can really rally together and get people to have it not ratified to change the Constitution. As for all of Pritzker's framing about the dire situation of Illinois' finances, he's got a lot on the line to get this thing passed for his own, you know, reputation and stake as a governor.
Well, we've got plenty of time, it sounds like, to talk about this over the next several weeks. We'll be hearing more, I'm sure. Let's switch gears to another issue that's on the governor's plate right now, and that is what to do about DCFS. It's an agency that's really coming under fire right now, and primarily for one case, although there have been many others, that's getting a lot of headlines here in central Illinois. Daisy, you covered a hearing this week. What took place?
Yeah, this is the latest in criticisms for the Child Welfare Agency, especially after a report came out in January that said that at least 98 children had died while under DCFS watch over the last 2 years. And this latest hearing, called by Representative Sushir, a Decatur Democrat, was on the death of 2-year-old Tanaja Barnes, who previously had a DCFS case. She was DCFS removed Tanaja from her home in at least 2 different occasions over the last year for issues of neglect and abuse. Her parents went through the necessary intervention programs, and caseworkers allegedly conducted their routine home visits. And in October of last year, they deemed her mom's home safe enough to close the case. Then in November, a mandated reporter called the DCFS hotline to report concerns about Tanaja and her brother possibly not getting the necessary vaccines. But there was no follow-up, and the call was designated to be a non-medical emergency. Then, just recently, February 11th, Tanaja's body was found in a cold room in a filthy, rotten-infested home with allegedly no running water. So both her mother and her mother's boyfriend have been charged with first-degree murder for causing the girl's death through a combination of starvation and neglect. So at the hearing, lawmakers were able to question DCFS Interim Director Deborah Deer Webster, who has only been on the job for 2 weeks. The agency, I think, has had over maybe 8 different directors over the last few years. Also present was Meryl Peniak, the DCFS Inspector General who investigates death cases. The DCFS director says it's very difficult to do any type of follow-up on closed cases, especially when a call to the hotline is categorized as being a non-threatening emergency. Lawmakers say it worries them that no red flags came up in their system. So this is a child who had a history of neglect in the home, and even though the case was closed, that there should have been some type of checkup just to make sure the child was doing okay. But there is no process currently in place that would allow this to happen.
Did anybody talk about some type of change, either legislative or otherwise, that might come out of this?
Yeah, so this was just a subject matter hearing, and I think lawmakers are thinking about what kind of language to draft up to something to tackle this legislative session. They want to deal with how DCFS deals with closed cases, how, you know, red flags can come up, and maybe how the agency is able to do that follow-ups. Another issue very important for them was the issue of communication between different entities. DCFS contracts with different organizations that do the home visiting aspect of these cases. And it is through these organizations that caseworkers that DCFS decides whether to close a case. So it seems that there's a lack of oversight. DCFS doesn't really provide much guidance on how they do their work. They just provide technical support. So lawmakers want to make sure that this process changes.
Isn't part of the problem also the fact that DCFS doesn't have enough people to do the work?
Yes, there's just a lot of different moving parts.
And I thought in this particular case, wasn't there suggestions that there had been incentives given to caseworkers to try and close cases more quickly?
And I think in the past that actually did came up in the last year, where gift cards were given as incentives for managers would be, you know, giving out gift cards. DCFS director says this was only a one-time thing that happened, and after that, to her knowledge, it hasn't happened.
Charlie, yeah, that strikes me as being a pretty bad idea.
And Charlie, this is really, I mean, I don't want to sound callous here, but we've heard these cases over and over through the years. I mean, this is, and I know there are a lot of good folks who work at DCFS and try to do a good job with it. So is it just a job that they're trying to do that's almost undoable?
Yeah, I would say, and I've watched, you know, state government for darn near half a century. And I think the toughest job in state government would be to be a DCFS caseworker, because you have to make judgments affecting the future of a child. And if you take the child away from the parents and put them in some other situation, the child could be worse off. If you leave the child with the parents, the child could wind up like Tanaja. So it's a life or death situation in all these cases, and you have to make these judgments. And with the agency sort of hollowed out, you don't have the kind of support you need to help you in this. So I think as I say, it's a tough job. It's been tough. We've had directors have been cycled through. A few of them have spent very much time at the head of the agency. Probably Jess McDonald had the longest tenure. He was back in Jim Edgar's time, well, with Jim Thompson and Jim Edgar. But it is a horrible job to have to try and do, and it's very difficult, and we don't provide the backup that's needed.
Brian, let's switch gears because I did want to get a couple other things in this week. Aaron Schock, I guess you could say, got some good news. The former congressman, charges against him that have been pending now for several years have now been dropped.
Yeah, it's called a deferred prosecution agreement. A lot of observers say this is very unusual when the feds come after someone, particularly a high-profile politician. They usually have a pretty airtight case to try and go off of, so this is an unusual agreement. So it is a deal in which Schock has some strings attached. He agreed to pay back taxes to the IRS and repay tens of thousands of dollars to his congressional campaign fund in exchange for basically having all the charges dropped against him if he stays out of trouble for 6 months. And we can remember this happened. This is a case that's been going on for, what, 3-4 years now. He was arraigned, I remember, shivering outside the federal courthouse here in Springfield in December of 2016. The case later moved to Urbana in Chicago. But this all came because the government said at the time that he had defrauded constituents and donors and the government itself out of more than $100,000, using that money for private airplane travel, stereo equipment, tickets to Bears games, and other sporting events, which he resold for a profit. He is alleged to have used government funds to pay a sort of personal photographer, which gave him a very enviable-looking Instagram account where he was surfing and mountain climbing and doing all this exciting sort of James Bond-type lifestyle. And ultimately, he says that this was a rogue prosecutor acting who wanted to make a name for himself, and for whatever reason, this case has had a lot of legal jousting over the years. The prosecutors decided, they're not talking, but they decided to agree to this deal where Schock basically has to pay a lot of money but gets to walk away without any sort of criminal record.
Just a few minutes left here. Tony, I want to turn to you because you wrote about this week. An aide to Speaker Madigan was in the news. Of course, that means that Speaker Madigan was in the news as well. Explain what the latest allegations that are that have been leveled there and what the Speaker's response was.
Sure. This is this information came from a lawsuit that's still working its way out in federal court here in Chicago. This is a campaign worker, Elena Hampton, is suing Speaker Madigan's political organizations for not properly handling her complaints of harassment. And in a court filing that her attorneys made, she has some allegations about how she has essentially been blacklisted from working in Democratic politics circles, basically saying that there are many campaigns that are afraid to work with her out of fear of retribution from Madigan. That's one claim that she's making. The other claim was that a staffer for the Speaker's office, she said she had learned that there were allegations against him of sexual harassment and or assault. After this was written about here on WBEZ, then Speaker Madigan's office released a statement giving some details about what happened with this staffer, saying that they received two allegations of intimidation and that this staffer threatened to make or break some careers and basically acknowledged, this was several years ago that this happened, and then basically acknowledging that that he was not disciplined or terminated after these allegations. Now, these were before the Harvey Weinstein stories started. And ever since that story's come out, it's just, you know, another part of this lawsuit that's going on against Madigan's political organizations. And we still have to hear from Madigan's attorneys about responding to some of these new allegations in court.
And Tony, do we know if this is going to come to court at some point soon, or have we heard anything like that?
No, I mean, I think these lawsuits take a long time. Both sides seem pretty entrenched and fighting this out and duking it out, and lawyers are kind of doing what they do, which is go back and forth about who do they want to hear from right now, who should be deposed or be talking about, how their interaction, other campaigns' interactions with Elena Hampton. And so, I don't know that there's a time when this is going to be wrapped up anytime soon. But then again, I'm not going to predict what lawyers are going to do or talk about in closed doors.
Daisy, you've been covering what some might call the Me Too movement at the State House, in the legislature, and in political circles in the state. This just shows that this is not over with yet, I guess. You know, there are maybe some people who think, well, changes have been made to improve the situation, but it's not going to go away quietly.
Yeah, I think that pest issues are going to continue creeping up, especially through these lawsuits. And I think there are stories that we still haven't heard about.
Let's go to our notes from the field. Charlie, let's start with you.
Okay. Well, one of the complaints over the years that third-party candidates and independents have had is that the process for getting on the ballot is stacked against them in favor of the established political parties, Republicans and Democrats. So legislation was introduced this past week, bipartisan legislation in the state Senate by Senator Jason Barrickman, who's a Republican from Bloomington, Senator Andy Menar, who is a Democrat from Bunker Hill, that would basically say if you want to run as an independent or as a third-party candidate, you only have to file as many petitions as a Republican or a Democratic candidate would have to do. So instead of having, for example, for statewide office, instead of having to file 25,000 signatures, you'd only have to file 10,000.
All right. Brian?
Yeah, there was a number of hearings in the past week or so as legislators begin the budget-making process in earnest. They do what's called a revenue estimate, and there's a group, a bipartisan group called the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, a bunch of economists and budget nerds there who sort of crunch the numbers, and they go out and they subscribe to various economic forecasting arms. And basically, what their report to the legislature is, we've had a really good year, a better than expected year in terms of income tax collections and sales tax collections. They say that's largely because Illinois has had reasonably low unemployment and growing wages. And so that combination has led to greater revenue. But they also say this is really about as good as it's going to get. And looking ahead to the next year, they're not necessarily predicting a full-blown recession, although that's a possibility. But they're definitely saying that growth is going to slow, which if that is true or if it's worse than that, the budget plans that people have been making and the amount of money that Governor Pritzker says he wants to raise with a graduated income tax could be thrown into chaos with the need for even more state revenue, because Illinois is particularly vulnerable in the event of a downturn.
Daisy?
With their continued budget problems, Western Illinois University laid off 132 employees. The possibility of layoffs were expected all year after budget cuts were announced at the beginning of the school year. And Western has gone through other faculty and staff layoffs in recent years, along with program cuts. And the state's budget crisis drastically reduced state funding for the university. Now, faculty members have launched a special petition to be delivered to the governor, urging him to appoint new board members and provide emergency funding.
All right, that's where we're going to leave it for this week. Members of our broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, Daisy Contreras, and Tony Arnold from WBEZ. Get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and find us at NPR One. Just look for State Week. Production assistance for the program provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.